So, what if we would talk about uniform visualizations and surrogates that include polygraphy?
Okay, since I'm a member of the International Organizing Committee, I thought it would be highly inappropriate to thank the organizers for inviting me. Although that explains why I was invited, of course. But I thought I would thank the local organizers, Alejandro, Jose Antonio, Robert, Daniele, and the students helping them. I mean, this conference is very important for our field. There's a lot of work, and we're very thankful that they did it for us. So. I'd like to talk about Stryker's metric spacetimes and loop quantum gravity. This is work we did with Rodolfo, which I think everyone knows here, and also with Miguel Campiglia, which I think very few of you know. He's the gentleman sitting next to Rodolfo down there. This is the plan of the talk. I'll first introduce things a little bit, talk about Stryker's metric gravity in general. I'll build a loopy presentation for the Stryker's metric exterior of a black hole. We'll do a direct quantization. We'll talk a little bit about the interior problem as well. And what are the expectations for more general models? So, of course, Stryker's metric spacetimes include Schwarzschild, therefore singularity, therefore they're interesting. They're sort of the next obvious thing to try after the success of loop quantum cosmology, so to add some spatial dependence into things. This is work in progress. We do not have results for the complete spacetime. As I said, we can treat the exterior of a black hole, we can treat the interior, but we still haven't found out a treatment. We haven't finished the treatment yet, but does everything at the same time. What you do now is there's always a trade-off. You can use special features of the model, and that simplifies things, but also then the model becomes less relevant to the full theory, and there's a little bit of tension there, and we're going to see it in our treatment here. We will do a direct quantization in the loop representation and discuss implications for other approaches. So Stryker's metacanonical quantum gravity has some history. With the traditional variables, there was work in the 1970s, listed here. These people were really trying to understand Hawking evaporation, so they had Stryker's metric gravity coupled to a scalar field, so that's considerably more complicated problem than the one we're going to look at today. We're going to look at today only at the vacuum Stryker's metric gravity, so there's really no dynamics. And so the definitive work in vacuum was done by Karl Kukesh and then supplemented a little bit by Madeline Varadarajan as well. What Kukesh did is he did something very clever. So he did not just take Stryker's symmetric gravity and quantize it, but he made a very careful choice of the canonical variables, separating the embeddings and the true degrees of freedom. After you did that heavy work classically, the direct quantization becomes a one-liner, basically. You end up with wave functions that are functions of the mass, the only degree of freedom in Stryker's symmetric gravity. The mass doesn't evolve, so the wave functions don't evolve, and that's it. If you want, you can call this a micro-superspace quantization because you've used almost everything you know about the model to quantize it. Of course, as a consequence of that, there's nothing that this quantization says about the singularity because it's entirely in terms of the pure degrees of freedom and the singularity goes along for the ride, so it's not eliminated in any way. So this quantization has very little in common with a full theory. We don't say anything about, say, for instance, using loop quantizations to do singularity elimination. So we'd like to do something a little bit less specialized, use less information, and just impose spherical symmetry, and then proceed to use the sort of usual quantization tools that have been discussed in this conference. Unfortunately, things quickly complicate, surprisingly. Suppose you want to just do sort of traditional variables quantization. It doesn't matter what variables you use. So, for instance, you take the traditional spherical symmetric adapted metric, and you can build a similarly adapted extrinsic curvature, for instance. When you write the constraints, you have one diffeomorphism constraint, which is the diffeomorphism along the radial line. The others are gauge fixed away. And you have the usual constraint algebra, and in particular, you have the algebra of two Hamiltonians with structure functions here. So this model, although it's very simple and has only one diffeomorphism constraint, it has the problem of the dynamics of the full theory. And therefore, we do not know how to treat this model this way, just with a pure direct quantization. One could try these more modern ideas like the master constraint that Thomas talked about, or the uniform discretizations that we have been looking at for a while. But it sort of looks like a shame that for such a simple model, one cannot sort of treat it with more traditional ideas. This problem is, of course, absent in homogeneous cosmologies, because there you have only one Hamiltonian, not one per point, and therefore H where H is automatically zero. There's no such term there. Here, as soon as you turn on a spatial dependence, this problem raises its ugly head. So we have to face it here. Let's now become a little bit more specialized and use a new variable, since we want to use loops. So, just to go to the punchline a little bit, what are we going to do about this? Well, we're going to use a special feature of spherical symmetry to get rid of this problem. Okay, so there's where there's one of these trade-offs. It's not something you're going to be able to do in the full theory, but you'll be able to do it in this model. So, to set up the model with the new variables, first of all, new variables with spherical symmetry have been looked at by several people. Benson was the first one to look at it. Then in a sort of forgotten paper, the thesis of Thomas, this is a very interesting paper because it was done in 1993, so it was previous to all the new developments, mathematical developments in the loop representation. So at the time in this paper, they were using complex new variables, and nevertheless, they noted that the constraint algebra was essentially abelian, and that the variables were essentially real. So if they had had the mathematical tools that we have now at our disposal, they could have finished the problem there, even though they were using the traditional sort of form of new variables. But this wasn't done, so historically that wasn't done. So this was, the whole problem was revisited with more modern techniques by Martin and Swiderski, and these papers will be very useful for us because we did a very careful analysis of how to set up spherical symmetry in new variables. So, you know, the connection takes this form, the triad takes this form. They noted that it's easier to sort of do like a polar canonical transformation in the variables to a new set of variables. And in particular, there's some subtleties that we also discussed about how to get canonical variables with appropriate fall-off, so you have to do a further canonical transformation. At the end of the day, you're left with three canonical pairs of variables. There's only one, x, by the way, in our notation is the radial direction. We don't want to use r because r has certain standard meanings like the Schwarzschild or whatever. These two variables are the only ones that really behave as a connection, and it's canonically conjugate momentum. These behave as scalar fields or scalar densities. The constraints take this form, so there's like one Gauss law left, one diffeomorphism constraint left, and one Hamiltonian, well, there's always one Hamiltonian. And just for sake of information, this is the sort of form they take in terms of those variables. What we're going to do now to treat this model is we'll fix the spatial coordinate gauge. You don't have to do this, but it really simplifies things. This eliminates the diffeomorphism constraint, but still leaves your Gauss law and a Hamiltonian, and the constraints are a first-class algebra with structure functions. So the problem is still hard. I mean, it simplifies it, but it still makes it a hard problem to deal with. The choice of gauge we do is this one. So the EX is just the X coordinate plus a variable A. And this puts the horizon at X equals zero. The variable A is a dynamical variable that is related to the mass of the space-time. One solves the diffeomorphism constraint for EX, substituted in H, and then one is one left for one equation for this canonical pair here. So Hamiltonian constraint becomes this expression here. It's a little bit simpler than before. But still, it's real algebra structure function. So there's the Gauss law is now abelian, Gauss for Hamiltonian commute, but Hamiltonian or Hamiltonian, so they have this non-trivial right-hand side and with a Hamiltonian there and the structure functions. So although we have simplified the models, it still has this problem of the dynamics, so you could try to use any of these new techniques to deal with it. But again, if one does that, people feel that this is a little bit of an overkill for these models. So what we'll do now is we'll make use of a trick that is only to our knowledge available for this model at the moment. And it's to note that if you take this constraint and divide it by E phi, the constraint becomes abelian. That is, these terms go away. Okay, so there's not a reparameterization, but just, you know, rewriting the Hamiltonian constraint turns it into an abelian Hamiltonian constraint. And the form of the constraint becomes so simple that even if you discretize things to regularize, if you want, the constraint remains abelian in its discrete version. That's non-trivial. In general, you know, constraints are abelian. If you discretize them, they fail to be abelian. In this particular case, it does, so that's sort of nice. So then we're going to quantize this discrete theory in the traditional Dirac way. And using the loop representation. So let us build a suitable loop representation for these models. So the manifold that we have, therefore, is in the line now, is the radial line. So there's not much left. The graph that one would have in the usual loop representation is just a set of edges along that line. So it's a union of edges. The only variable that behaves as a connection, as I said before, is this AX. The other variables are really scalar variables. So in the loop representation, you would represent them as you want. Normally it does, using point harmonics, as using the Weyl algebra for the scalars, to represent them. I didn't want to go through the whole loop representation for the full theorem and particularize it for the sort of gauge fixed way, so let me just show you the gauge fixed version. There, AX is gone, so there's no variable that is a connection anymore. So the only variable left, which is this A phi, or alternatively K phi, here gamma is the noisy parameter, this variable behaves as a scalar, and therefore we're going to treat it as normally scalar we've done in the loop representation by looking at the Weyl algebra. So one introduces, you know, T variables is just the exponentiation of this with a parameter there, let's call it mu. And one can introduce a Hilbert space, which is n copies along the line of the Borel compactification. So what's going on, for those of you who can see this from the back, is that we have the radial line, we have points in this line, and at each point you're essentially having a loop quantum cosmology, okay, with its appropriate Hilbert space, and that's why you have n copies along that line. The triads, of course, act very well in these states, as usual. This is a traditional loop stuff. The volume operator is well-defined. So classically, the volume of an interval of that radial line takes this form. And quantum mechanically, the volume is a well-defined operator. It takes this form. Now, there's something interesting in this volume operator that we'll get back to at the end of this talk, and namely is that the volume is really proportional to L prime squared, not L prime cubed. We'll see that has implications, and we'll discuss that later. You can introduce a basis of loop states as usual, and you have the Borel measure, the orthogonal, so this is just sort of standard thing, except that instead of having, like, a loop quantum cosmology, one number here for each of these, you have n copies, one for each point on, sort of, the radial line. The harmonics are, of course, well-defined quantum operators acting in these states, as is written here, the triads as well, so this is all fairly standard. One can do the Zeeman trick if you want to, because there's a billion other trick we're doing, in the end you don't need this to represent the Hamiltonian constraint, but it's there for you if you want to do it. It also hints at the fact that the inverse volume factor is going to be regular, and therefore there's potential for eliminating the singularity. Yeah, this one can represent this abelian Hamiltonian we had in the loop representation. What we'll do first is discretize it, write in terms of quantities that are easy to promote into the loop representation. That is, we will replace connections by small harmonics, etc., as it's usually done. So just to recall, this is the Hamiltonian we want to look at, the one that was abelian. And this is a harmonized version of it. What's gone on here is instead of that A that we have there, we now represent that by sine rho A divided by rho squared. For some reason, in the spherical language, the variable that he's called mu in the loop quantum cosmology is called rho, so it's that variable there. So in the limit rho going to zero, this sort of reproduces this term. But outside of that limit, this function is essentially a harmony, and therefore it's easy to quantize. You just put a hat on top of that, and it's automatically well-defined in the loop representation. It actually turns out that you can solve a constraint in connection representation, so let me do that first. So you rewrite it, basically. If you juggle around this expression, you end up with this expression here. And it turns out you can find states that sort of, if you act with hats on both sides on this state, you get this. This state looks sort of impressive. There's this phase factor here that has these functions, which actually are elliptic integrals and so on. They're sort of messy. But this is why it's really relevant, because these functions are given. That is, they're given functions. So it doesn't play much role. The whole action, the whole meat of the theory has been left in these C's here, which are functions of the canonical variable A that we introduced, which is related to the mass, and another canonical variable at the boundary, which is the proper time at the boundary. It turns out that this Hamiltonian that we have here is a Hamiltonian in the bulk, because you have a manifold of boundaries, you have to also impose a constraint on the boundary. If you do that, that has some effect on this. And by imposing the constraint of the boundary, this function just becomes a function of A, a given times a given phase factor, but it's not terribly relevant. So essentially what has happened here is we have, if it weren't for the font, this would say Kukash. So what we have done is we have recovered the Kukash quantization. The only freedom that we have in the theory is a wave function, C is any function you want, of the mass. And this is the quantization that Kukash has found. So, this is very nice, because we treat a big theory. We used boundary conditions at the horizon that are actually isolated boundary conditions, so the theory is completely well-defined in the exterior. And when we covered the quantization that Kukac had, by applying directly this machinery of the loop representation. So this is what I just said before. There's no dynamics, it doesn't evolve, it's a constant of the motion. So how does it look in the loop representation? Well, again, you can juggle around the constraint a little bit. So you rewrite the constraint as before, and it turns out to be easy to implement the square of the constraint as an operator. So that's what it looks like in the loop representation. Now, if you squint your eyes and don't look too much at the coefficients, this recursion relation that one is getting here, linking these three things, is very similar to the one that one got in loop quantum cosmology, except that now the factors are position dependent. So it again reinforces the idea that we have sort of n copies of loop quantum cosmology happening at each points of the manifold. What is interesting is that you can actually take that psi that we had written before, that exact solution, transform it into a loop representation, stick it in there, and actually show that it solves this recursion relation, which of course it should. But I'm always surprised when I see this happen, so it's sort of nice that one can do it here. Okay, so fine. This completes the quantization of the exterior. And therefore, you might ask, well, but you have to do that trick there. What would have happened if you hadn't done that trick? If you hadn't abelianized the constraint, what would you have done? Well, you could have used the master constraint. Thomas talked about that, so I won't repeat that. We would have used this other technique that is closely related, in a sense, as you're going to see, called uniform discretization that we have been sort of studying for the last few years. So in a nutshell, what is this technique? This technique is to discretize the theory in this way. Take any variable in your theory, whatever canonical variable you have, and write an evolution equation that links the variable at instant n with the variable at instant n plus 1 in this given way, where h, this function h here, is not really a Hamiltonian, but it's a sum squared of the constraints. Notice, therefore, the power of the master constraint. So if you implement this discrete theory, we have shown that in various examples and so on can approximate well the continuum theory, so it's a good discretization of the theory, that has among its properties the fact that, of course, this quantity itself is preserved by this evolution. So if I start slightly off the constraint surface with this quantity being small, this evolution guarantees that this will remain small. Some of you have heard me speak in the past of a previous approach that we had called consistent discretizations that was closely related but didn't have this desirable property that your discretizations were completely under control in the sense of approximating the continuum theory for all the evolution. This sort of fixes that. More generally, you could do something different here. You could take a function of the constraints that vanishes when the constraint vanishes and has non-vanishing second derivatives. But just, if this is the first time you see it, just think of this as the sum square of the constraints, and that's enough. So this is what I just said before. These are desirable properties. If you take initial data such as h is small, it remains small, so it remains close to the constraint surface. The main challenge, once you build this discrete approximation to the theory you want, is to implement this operator h as a quantum operator and check that zero is in the spectrum, because if zero is in the spectrum, you're on the constraint surface. Now, this is not an easy calculation to do for unless your model is really very simple. And in general, just like in the master constraint, as Thomas pointed out, it isn't guaranteed that zero is going to be in the spectrum of h. What you can at least demand, if that is not the case, is that h be as small as you can. So in particular, as we all know, when one discretizes theories, there's huge ambiguities in the discretization. It gets worse the more complicated the models. I mean, Abayan has talked a little bit about ambiguities that appear in the loop quantum cosmology case, and there things are fairly under control. But once you start adding spatial dependence, the possibilities for making different discretizations grow enormously. So there's a lot of ambiguity in how you discretize the theory. So you can use that criterion to pick what is the best discretization for you, the one that minimizes the eigenvalues of H. So this is a nice sort of guide. So we use this as a criterion for choosing the best discretization possible. In this model, of course, the best discretization is the one I show you, is the one that makes the constraints abelian, because then automatically I can find eigenstates of H that are annihilated by H. So you could construct H and show that 0 is the eigenvalue. And since the method, we have shown a little theorem that this method actually agrees with the Dirac method for abelian constraints, there's no point in going through all this, okay? So if you want, the previous quantization I showed you was a way of implementing all this, albeit a very clever, tricky one, using all sorts of things that you know from the model. And a more general model, you have to proceed with this in a more sort of blind way. But in a sense, what we did before achieves with for the model in question. So this is sort of nice. So what would only happen if in a more general model? So you might say, well, here you did it because it was very easy, but if the model had been more complicated, what would you do? And in particular, what would H look like? Would you really have 0 in the spectrum or not? So to get a handle of that, what one can do is take the states, the exact quantum states that we have for this model, and just use a different discretization for H. The states will now fail to be states of H, and we can see what sort of failure one gets. So if I do that, so if I take the states, the exact states I had, and stick here on H, there's different, discretizing a different way than the one we had, so this is not exactly 0, one gets an expression of this sort. So A is the mass as before, epsilon is a special spatial separation of the points sort of in the radial direction, L prime is L prime. Now, if one stays with this expression for a while and see all the bright coefficients that depend on which H you stick in there, but generically you won't get something like this. Now, if you stare at this expression, what you notice is that if I take L prime to 0, so if I look at just the classical theory, all this goes away. And therefore, in the classical theory, in the classical limit, I can indeed take epsilon going to 0 and recover the continuum theory. So what I'm saying is the classical continuum limit does exist for this theory. However, if I run in the full quantum theory now, I have epsilons in the denominator. And as a consequence, the discrete quantum theory I have doesn't have a proper continuum limit. So I have a classical continuum theory, I have the discrete classical theory, that limit I can take. I quantize the discrete theory, I have a quantum discrete theory, this limit I cannot take. Okay? I can get close, I can try to make this as small as possible, but I cannot take the limit. And that's sort of what you would expect in general to happen. This parallels what Thomas mentioned in the sort of master constraint. One doesn't expect the master constraint for generic models to have 0 in its eigenspectrum. One expects to have a minimum eigenvalue, and therefore your quantum theory will approximate the classical theory very well for many states, but it won't approximate the classical theory for all states, which I think is reasonable. So this is a rephrasing of that. The limit epsilon 0 L prime finite has problems. On the other hand, you have a classical continuum limit epsilon 0 L prime going to 0. Now, suppose you wanted to solve this problem, okay? So you wanted to actually find these eigenstates. How would you do it? Well, the problem becomes a really hard problem in quantum mechanics, akin to those in solid-state physics. I mean, some people get discouraged when I say this, but, I mean, what do you expect, right? I mean, you're doing quantum gravity with spatial degrees of freedom. It couldn't be simpler than condensed matter physics, right? It is encouraging to know that, of course, because it's very similar to what is done in condensed matter physics, there's a lot of technology to do this. So there's even a, you know, Wikipedia article where you'll find the same expression I was talking about, and because this is possible definite, you can rewrite it this way, and actually apply the Monte Carlo technique to do this. So there is all sorts of technology to do this, there's codes, etc. So it shouldn't be that daunting a problem. So my sort of commitment is, I don't know if by next year, but certainly for 2 years from now, we ought to have something going numerically in terms of this. Now, you might say, why would you possibly want to do all this numerical work just for a straight to symmetric vacuum reality? Of course, you don't want to do that. What you want to do is you want to up the ante a little bit. So for instance, the complexity of all these expressions changes very little if you couple general relativity, say, to a scalar field. Recall all the variables we had were essentially scalar fields. So adding one more doesn't make a difference. So what I'm saying is, within 2 years, we could be dealing with, say, quantum chapter problem, or the quantum collapse of a scalar field. Forget this one, because this one's going to be really difficult. But at least studying the collapse of a scalar field to form a black hole, quantum mechanics with these type of techniques is not far-fetched nor out of the question. One can also study the CGHS black hole that I mentioned just by adding one more scalar field. So this, in my view, appears very promising, reasonably short-term, and reasonably concrete way of doing a quantum calculation of some complexity in the theory without getting completely out of control. Let me mention now a little bit about the interior problem. Okay, so this is relatively new, so we're not completely done. Of course, the interior problem has been tackled because, as people know, the interior of Schwarzschild black hole is isometric to the Kankowski-Sachs universe, so Marion Boyer-Weld, Abarashtika, Leonardo Modesto, and other people have written papers about this using that. It is interesting to notice that the ansatz that we did for the geometry is general enough to include a Kankowski-Sachs universe. So if we go back to the very first sort of set of constraints we had, all of these really are appropriate enough to deal with Kankowski-Sachs. In that case, it's a little bit better to choose a slightly different gauge fixing that we had before and gauge fix the Gauss law. If one does that, one is left with a diffeomorphism and a Hamiltonian constraint here. I want to proceed and, by further gauge fixing, just get the Kankowski-Sachs solution if one wants to do that. So one is left with a super-Hamiltonian that sort of has this form. This is the diffeomorphism constraint still there. And further gauge fixing, so this diffeomorphism constraint that we have there implies that the variable k is independent of r, and is determined by an ODE, which together, if you want your lapse to be independent, of course, I mean, I have to make choices, right? You don't get Kankowski-Sachs if you take a lapse and a shift that depend on the data coordinates in arbitrary ways. You quickly get the solution for k that comes from usual Kankowski-Sachs, and a similar sort of carefully choosing the gauge ends up with E, giving you the traditional form of Kankowski-Sachs in the interior. So this whole approach that we're doing is completely suitable for dealing with a Kankowski-Sachs situation. Of course, we don't want to do that. What we would like to do is take a few steps back, pretend that we don't know all this, and try to implement the Hamiltonian that we had, quantum mechanically, and see what happens. So that's what I'm going to do now. So we start with the Hamiltonian constraint that we had before. So I just recall the expression here. We harmonize it. We again sort of wire in such a way that this is easy to promote into the loop representation. And so this would be the quantized version of this acting in a state in the connection representation here. I want to proceed to solve this, just like we did before, solving the connection representation. To do that, what we'll do is do a sort of WKB ansatz. So we'll assume the state has a form like this, where there's a function here, there's another function there, and this function C, we will assume it has an expansion in terms of Planck length of this form. If you do that, you can stick this in there and solve this equation order by order in Planck's constant. So at the zeroth order, one gets this equation here. A and B are just given functions of K that I didn't write explicitly because it's clutters the transparency. If you go to first order, you get this equation here. This sort of looks intimidating, but it's not. If you stare at this for a little while, you realize that this equation, although it looks quadratic and so on, it's actually a square of a quasi-linear PDE for S. And once you solve that equation for S, if you stick it in here, this equation is a quasi-linear PDE for C0. And you can continue this game on, all orders, and you always get a quasi-linear equation for the relevant C. So you can proceed to solve this problem in this sort of iterative way. The solution for S actually can be found exactly for this equation, is written down here. And one could proceed and try to study what is the dynamics of this theory. By the way, before doing that, let me point out something of interest. This technique, we're not doing it just for doing it. I mean, you might ask, when I put that Wikipedia page up there, all those variational techniques, of course, require an initial guess for your state. It has to be reasonably good if your model is complicated. How are you going to come up with an initial guess for your model? Well, this technique for solving the Hamiltonian constraint, order by order, will probably provide a very good guess to start these numerical Monte Carlo techniques. So the idea is in the future one would like to couple these two ideas together. So let's try to understand the classical solutions of this action. Let me say a few words about this, because here different terminology can lead to a certain amount of confusion. Recall that the theory we have here is this theory has been harmonized. So where we took the Hamiltonian that came from the Einstein equations, if you want, and replaced certain quantities by these quantities that are easy to implement in the loop representation. And these two expressions agree in this limit rho going to zero, but we normally don't take that limit. So if you don't take that limit, these two theories are different. General relativity, classical, and this other classical theory that we have, in general, are different. They only agree if your curvatures are small. If your curvatures are small, those expressions involving sine or rho, etc., become equal to the ones we started from without taking the limit rho going to zero. So what I'm going to describe now are classical solutions for this theory that is not Einstein's theory. It approximates Einstein's theory when curvatures are small. Okay? So that's what we're going to look at. So in particular, one notices that the classical solutions of the theory are singularity free. But they require careful conditions for tunneling through the singularity, and this is the point I want to raise because I think it's interesting, and we don't fully understand it yet, as again, because this is recent, but it might lead to further understanding of the bounds in this Kantowski-Sachs case, which I think there's still open questions there. So, this is a problem for one of these solutions. So what you do is you solve a solution in phase space, and then you plot the volume for it, and you plot the Kantowski-Sachs time for the solution. Kantowski-Sachs time is not a monadism function of the planar time that you have in phase space. So what you see is your solution sort of comes down to small volume, and this sort of bounces back. The reason for this is in this region, the curvatures are not small, and therefore the theory is not approximating general relativity very well. It's actually mimicking the kind of stuff that happens when you quantize the theory in sort of loop quantum cosmology fashion. Something to be observed here is that the rate of sort of tunneling into a singularity and the rate of bouncing out of a singularity is not the same. Okay? And that's sort of puzzling. Why would it be asymmetric like that? Well, it depends a little bit on what you're trying to do. We call that in the end, what we want to do here, is we want to have a black hole. Let me draw it with my hands if I can. Inside that black hole, there's this Kantowski-Sachs universe that sort of tunnels into another universe, but presumably there's another black hole on the other side. For all that picture to be consistent, there are certain boundary conditions that have to be satisfied at the Kantowski-Sachs horizon. Okay? Otherwise, you don't match these things well. In terms of these variables that we have here, this stopped working, I guess. So in terms of these variables, the sort of boundary condition that boils down that you want to have at the horizon is that these two variables be zero at the Kantowski-Sachs horizon. Now, if you demand that at the sort of outside horizon and also at the horizon that arises after tunneling to the singularity, then remarkably, the evolution retraces itself and the bounce is symmetric. If you just demand this at the sort of exterior black hole and don't say anything else, generically this doesn't happen. You get something like this. And notice, what you get is you tunnel through the singularity and you don't tunnel into a universe where curvatures remain small. And therefore this theory isn't approximating general relativity at all. And in fact, inside, you don't develop a Kantowski-Sachs universe in a black or what could be the interior of a black hole. For that to happen, you need fine-tuning of this in the exterior and also the interior, or alternatively, because the theory is deterministic, to impose this in the exterior and some additional conditions at the outside horizon, such as after you tunnel, you enter a regime where curvature is small, you approximate general relativity well, and you just get the usual Kantowski-Sachs things. This, something akin to this, I mean, I don't want to not say too much that I'm very sure about this, because what we're doing here is rather weird. This is a classical theory that sort of mimics features of the quantization. But it is known that in the loop quantum cosmology case for the anisotropic cases, the recursion relations that appear for the Hamiltonian constraint suffer from instabilities. And in particular, it's known for the Kantowski-Sachs case that they do suffer from instabilities. I mean, we have been a little more precise with that. All these treatments have been done with a so-called U0 version of loop quantum cosmology, the old-fashioned stuff. I think no one has yet looked in loop quantum cosmology carefully to the new bar case for Kantowski-Sachs. We haven't done it either. So I'm talking all this stuff here, but I'm comparing apple to apple, so to speak. So these recursion relations are known in the loop quantum cosmology to have instabilities, and it appears to us that these instabilities are the same we're going here, namely, you have to really fine-tune things in the initial data, so you tunnel through the singularity, and then you develop a classical space-time further. If you don't do that, you tunnel through the singularity, but then you have the instabilities in the recursion relations in loop quantum cosmology imply that you don't achieve a semi-classical limit in the end. So I think these two are sort of related, but unfortunately we haven't translated things back and forth, so I think that at the moment this is improving. But what is not used to be done is really to do a proper comparison between these sort of different electronic cosmology version of things and this one. This is sort of interesting that the truth interior problem and sort of do a connection there. Just by creating the problem directly in the connection representation, look at this effective classical theory. Let me include here one last intriguing observation, and this was really very surprising. Let me go back to now the exterior problem, okay? So we're just looking at the exterior. As you saw, the quantization is very simple. We covered a squeak-up thing. One doesn't expect anything unusual to happen there. Let me show you something really unusual does happen, and has to do with holography. Namely, as I mentioned before, the volume operator had this strange form without Planck square there. Now, if you sort of take the holonomy as a well-defined operator and you keep your rho, or in loop quantum cosmology terminology, the mu parameter, fixed, when you act with a holonomy in one of the loop states, it increments its volume by this amount here. Why do you care about this? Well, because suppose you want to build a theory in this kinematics. Suppose you want to look at general relativity coupled to a scalar field, or coupled to whatever you want. You're going to have a Hamiltonian constraint that involves the matter, and that involves this holonomy. So when you act with a Hamiltonian constraint on your states, they're going to change the volume by at least this amount. So very generically, one can make the statement that in this kinematics, the volume of space increments itself in this way. And what we're saying is not proportional to L Planck cube, but L Planck squared. And this is a sort of relationship between the volume and L Planck that has been discussed by various people heuristically in the context of holography. Jack E, or Jack Eng, and Seth Lloyd and others, Rodolfo, in fact, in his talk on Monday, presented these arguments in some detail, both of them. But it's remarkable this idea appears here completely at a kinematical level in loop quantum gravity without making any assumption about the dynamics, and it appears in a rather powerful way. No matter what dynamics you put there, unless you do something really crazy, you're going to have this type of behavior. So, well, this just repeats what I just said. This would couple survive a couple of other theory, just scalar field or any other sorts of matter. So if you can consider a shell, we recall we are in the exterior, so we don't want to take a ball to not involve the interior, so you take a shell out there, so our treatment is really applicable. And you look at the elements of volume per shell, and you stick this in there, you find that the number of elementary volumes that you have in a shell is proportional to the shell area divided by Planck scale, and this is the Bekenstein bound. So remarkably, the Bekenstein bound seems to be hard-coded into the kinematics of loop quantum gravity and spherical symmetry. And I find this extremely powerful, because, I mean, it's really not dependent on any assumptions about the dynamics. Okay, so if you want to really get this expression, you need to choose the standard value for the energy parameter. And, of course, if you want this to be the Bekenstein bound, you should connect the number of elementary volumes with the entropy, assuming there is, sort of entropy density that is for unit volume that is constant. Now, you might say, well, but, okay, you got this result. This result doesn't look like it will survive breaking spherical symmetry or in any obvious way. Is this of interest, therefore? Isn't this just an accident of spherical symmetry? Well, it might be claimed that that is the case, but you have to recall that this naive version of the Bekenstein bound saying that things are proportional to the area is really only valid in spherical symmetry itself. As was mentioned by David Weilraut, if you really want to deal with situations that are not spherical symmetry, one has to use these generalizations of Boussot and others that are much more subtle than this, okay? So in fact, this result couldn't have held, it would have been very surprising if this result held in anything but in the spherical symmetric context. So there's a certain correspondence there. It's not surprising that this came out in spherical symmetry, and it's not surprising that it wouldn't survive in this form beyond spherical symmetry. I find it quite remarkable that in such a simple model with no dynamics, with just looking at the kinematics, one could get this result. So since I'm running out of time, let me conclude. So the message is one can study spherical symmetric spacetimes using loop quantum gravity. One needs to use special features if you just want to do a straight Dirac quantization. If not, the model is complicated enough that you have to use these more modern techniques. The setup is ready, and we now need to sort of batch all of this together by using horizon-penetrating coordinates. We're sort of confident that because both the interior and the exterior work, this will be possible relatively soon to be able to make now better statements about the singularity. to do something a little bit more than just the usual Kankowski facts treatment is, and you'd have something that is completely connected. Without using special tricks, the problem is hard, but it is a simple problem, sort of simple arena where you can try out these new ideas, the master constraint and the uniform discretizations. And it's rather surprising that holography and the Bekenstein bound can be connected hardwired to the sort of basic elements of loop bound gravity irrespective of the details of the dynamics. Thank you.
Questions?
So this is a speculative question and a comment following. So in the situation where the number of degrees of freedom seems to be going like the area of the shell, if you turn on some typical dynamics, would you expect that the specific heat is proportional to the area rather than the volume?
Let's see. So the key observation here is this. Any dynamics you turn on will involve the on in one way or the other, and you'd increment the volume in this way. What will that do to a specific heat? I don't know if I can answer it that fast.
Okay, I mean, there's a nice, if you could discover a specific heat before you that if you have a thermal bath of radiation, three dimensions, but some weird radiation with specific heat proportional to the area rather than the volume, then the spectrum of fluctuations is scaling there.
Well, let me think about that. I think there will be a far stretch from this context to make statements about fluctuations and so on. So, yeah, but I'll look into that.
Colby?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you the same question I asked earlier. The assertion view of this running important finding of some sort that is innate, intrinsic to the loop gravity, to have such a relation in the X and holography. Does the discretization of the area, does that come naturally in it or in some way that you put in my hand?
I hate this question. The word naturally is not a scientific word, right? There is a context here for doing quantum gravity, which is loop quantum gravity. There are a set of rules. And if you apply these rules to this, this is what comes out. Of course, it's a choice. As Abai said, we could have chosen to do quantum gravity using real Lewitt variables and whatever measure we can cook up there, and then nothing of this would show up. There would be no discreteness of the area. There would be nothing. So if you want to call that putting it by hand, okay, it's putting it by hand. If you want to call it, well, there's a framework to address issues that seems to have worked in a variety of contexts, and we're just applying it here, and therefore it's natural, it's natural.
Right. So the question here is the implication that you seem to be drawing in a very fundamental way.
Yeah, but see, all implications that we draw depend on this.
No, I mean,
quantum cosmology wouldn't bounce if this fact weren't there. People have studied with quantum cosmology. So quantum cosmology traditionally with the Wheeler-Lewis theory, and they weren't able to eliminate the singularity. So the predictions depend on this. So I think at some point I can make your peace with this and say, well, this is the framework. I'm going to use it in a value context, gain confidence, etc. And if it works, it works.
Yes.
I think there's a comment there.
People always come on the theory, right? For example, in some of the calculations, they came up with ideas in the late 70s. It certainly was, it wasn't even quantum gravity, it certainly has to be gravity. And if you do something similar to what you described, you're looking at the two side coasts and demand that they go to a reasonable thing of doing it as well, then they actually got the dynamics there without making any assumption explicitly or implicitly of the area. So I have great respect for the whole program, that's why I want to really understand that issue. I don't think it's a trivial thing.
I mean, what I said is what I think about this. I mean, I don't really think it's a completely scientifically issue. I mean, it's once you have a framework, you apply it. Any other comment there?
Just a comment. I think Makul says a little bit stronger than what Ole said. It certainly did this framework. But I don't think it's completely dependent on dynamics, because one is using this holonomy to represent curvature, and that curvature thing is coming in dynamics. So it's true that one can just say that just choose this particular endpoint and then do the models, but that is really inspired. I mean, it is necessary for dynamics. If it is not for dynamics, one could consider the whole real life and physical real life.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So it's kind of deeply dependent on the dynamics. But after that, the statement is really that it is the replacement of the speed strength of homology within the context of loop geometry is giving us about the one thing we did not have to talk about, see what the relation is.
If I understand correctly, this Wittgenstein bound comes out of this equation in which the equations of the volume go like pancreas.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is so because there's this rho there which is dimensional.
Yes.
So if I think that
the
full theory will be able to derive these things, where is this rho going to come from?
Well, so that's what perhaps too cryptically was being said here. If we believe the full theory where rho has a minimum value, I mean, this is the way loop quantum cosmology is inspired to also take a rho that has a sort of minimum value and don't take the limit rho going to zero.
Rho is
dimensionless. So. Yeah, so this has dimensions of length.
Don't we think from the full theory, okay, so the question is, from the full theory, how can we obtain something with the volume which is proportional to Pancreas square? What is the light dimension of the
particle that's drawn from? So, I'm certainly going to answer that from the full theory, you know, I have that calculation. There have been heuristic arguments that apply to sort of generic quantum gravity that lead to this type of expression, so it's not incredibly out of the blue, but I agree with you that it's sort of difficult to imagine precisely what mechanism in the full theory would lead to this rather than L Planck cubed.
What I said, right? Namely that this is true only in a spherical symmetry. It would not be true in complete generic situations.
No, I mean, but the question from the full theory
in the spherical symmetric context, mm-hmm. where one has some semi-classical states, then this is basically saying that there's a radial direction. That is x mu plus a, very heuristically speaking. And then there is the area part. And the area part is a p square. So I think this, I mean, that's very carefully said, that this is really okay. In the context of spherical symmetry.
Only. The mass is black hole, so the scale.
Yeah.
I'm taking a lot of questions because what actually occurs
I'm intrigued by your suggestion beginning to look at this chapter type effect. So in this framework, would you have a hope of seeing this scaling this self-similar?
Okay, so out of the word chaptric was put there to provoke people. At the moment, I think what it, reasonably one would like to do is look at some collapse, perhaps of some shallow scalar field, form a black hole, perhaps not even do that, perhaps do the CGHS, where one actually has the exact solution for that, and then study quantum fluctuations of that. If you are able to overcome all the difficulties that I expect there and make some sense of that, then you could start playing and saying, well, you know, make small black holes and see what happens. How could I possibly answer that today? I mean, what I'm saying is there's a path to try to reach that, and we might get bogged down with difficulties in the middle, certainly.
A result of this theory, or
an ideas? So at the moment, the way we've done it is for the exterior and for the interior, we have a classical theory of a well-defined boundary initial value problem with isolated horizon boundary conditions. So in that sense, if you want, it's put in by hand, both for the exterior and in the interior also, because when you're assuming there's Kantowski facts and there's a horizon with appropriate boundary conditions there. It would be more interesting if we can do this for your Kruskal treatment, then see how the horizon arises, but at the moment that's not done.
Are there
any
more questions?
Can
I ask one?
Do
you have time?
You're probably aware of the work of Hitchcock and Houston and so on, who actually studied the back reaction problem in the interior of the black hole, the same Kantowski effects, similar to what was one of the situations with people.
Yeah.
And they, have you compared that?
No, but that's back reaction with fluctuations, right?
Not necessarily. There's this good old back reaction, just like in the late
70s. Just in the pure quantum cosmology case, you mean, without the spatial fluctuations?
No fluctuations.
Okay, that piece of work I wasn't aware of. I was aware of the later sort of Anderson and Hiscock things where they sort of look at, and therefore I didn't think it was relevant for this. So I could, we could probably take a look at that.
But the reason I ask is because that is the same class.
Okay, so it also would be interesting to compare that with Boyer and Astrigar and so on in the loop representing. I agree.
In the regular system.
Yeah.
What the speakers?